All right, welcome back everyone to the Deep Dive. We're diving into a pretty significant case today, legal case that is. We're looking at Burns v. McGregor Electronic Industries, a 1993 case out of the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals.
Yeah, this one's a biggie, and I think, it's going to be particularly interesting for those of you out there interested in employment law.
Definitely. We're going to break down how this case really challenged some pretty damaging assumptions about workplace harassment and, who deserves protection under the law. We're going to look specifically at how it impacted the concept of, blaming the victim.
In the context of hostile work environment claims,
Yeah.
which of course fall under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
Right, exactly. So we've got a lot to unpack. I'm coming at this from more of a legal analysis angle.
And I'll be bringing my expertise on Title VII to the table.
Great. So with all that said, let's get into the specifics of Burns v. McGregor. To set the scene, this case involves a woman named Lisa Burns.
Right, Lisa Burns. She was employed kind of on and off at McGregor Electronics. This was between, let's see, 1980 and 1984.
Okay, so 4 years, but not necessarily continuous employment. And during this time, she faced some serious harassment.
Oh, yeah. We're not talking about just one isolated incident. This was a sustained pattern of harassment. And it really played out on a few different, fronts, I guess you could say.
Okay, so break down those different fronts for us. Like, what exactly were Burns dealing with?
All right, so the first layer of this hostile environment was it came from the owner of the company himself, Paul Oslak.
The owner. Wow. Okay, so not just a coworker or supervisor. We're talking the top guy.
Exactly. And we're not talking subtle hints or anything. He repeatedly made sexual advances toward Burns. It wasn't just awkward flirting. He was like physically cornering her, constantly asking her out. At one point, he even flat out asked her to perform a sexual act.
Oh, wow. So, yeah, way over the line. And coming from the owner, that creates a huge power imbalance right off the bat.
Absolutely. But unfortunately, the harassment didn't stop there.
So there's more.
Oh, yeah. There was a second layer of harassment. This time, it came from Burns's male coworkers. They would routinely display pornographic materials in the workplace, in places where she would see them. And they frequently called her, well, really degrading names.
Like what? Can you give some examples?
They'd call her slut, things like that. Really sexually charged, derogatory language.
Ah, that's awful. So you've got the owner harassing her, and then you've got this constant barrage of inappropriate behavior from coworkers. What was the company's response to all this?
That's the truly frustrating part. Burns reported the harassment. She went to McGregor Electronic Industries, told them what was going on, but they did absolutely nothing.
They just ignored it.
It seems that way. They just swept it under the rug. And, this inaction really speaks volumes about the company culture and how they view their responsibility to protect their employees.
Yeah, no kidding. So all of this is already bad enough, but then there's this third element you mentioned, the incident that seems to have been the final straw.
Right. So this involved a coworker named Eugene Ottaway. It started as a disagreement, but quickly escalated. It ultimately led to a screaming match, and that's when Ottaway really crossed the line.
What happened?
He called Burns a fingsy.
Oh my God.
I know, right? I mean, it's just such a vile, hateful, gendered slur. And for Burns, it was the breaking point. She resigned immediately after that incident.
Yeah, I can't imagine how she could possibly stay in that environment after that.
Exactly. And this is where things start to get even more complicated, legally speaking, because this case ended up going to trial.
And I understand the initial trial court ruling was, well, let's just say it wasn't exactly a victory for Burns.
Not at all. So the trial court actually ruled against Burns. And one of the most troubling aspects of this ruling was how they viewed a specific detail about Burns' life outside of work.
You're talking about the fact that Burns had posed for Easy Riders magazine, right?
Exactly. Now, it's important to note that she had done this both before she started working at McGregor Electronics and during her employment there.
Okay, so it was something she was open about. But how did this become a factor in the trial?
Well, incredibly, the trial court essentially used this against her. They implied that because Burns had posed for a men's magazine, she somehow wouldn't be offended by the harassment she experienced at work.
Seriously, that's insane. They basically said, oh, you pose for Easy Rider, so you must be okay with being called a slut and having your boss proposition you.
Yeah, in a nutshell, that was their logic. It was a textbook example of victim blaming. The idea that because of choices she made in her personal life, choices that had nothing to do with her job, she had somehow forfeited her right to a respectful and safe work environment.
It's a ridiculous argument, and frankly, kind of shocking that a court would even entertain it.
Totally agree. And to make matters worse, the trial court also decided that the harassment Burns endured wasn't severe or pervasive enough to qualify as a hostile work environment.
So they dismissed the owner's advances, the coworker's behavior, everything.
Pretty much. They seemed to view each instance in isolation, rather than seeing them as part of a larger, ongoing pattern of harassment.
Mm.
And to top it all off, they attributed Burns' resignation to a simple personal dispute with Ottaway, as if that final incident could be separated from the broader context of harassment.
Wow. Talk about minimizing her experience. So understandably, Burns appealed this decision, right? I mean, it's hard to imagine a more messed up ruling. Where did the appeal go?
It went to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. And this is where Burns v. McGregor starts to become a landmark case.
Okay, so tell me, what happened at the Eighth Circuit? Did they overturn the trial court's decision?
They did, and not just once, but twice. The first time, the Eighth Circuit sent the case back down to the trial court, essentially saying, hey, you guys got this completely wrong. You need to take another look.
So the Eighth Circuit really thought the initial ruling was that bad, huh?
Oh, yeah. They identified several fundamental errors in the trial court's reasoning. And even after the trial court revisited the case, they still messed it up. So the Eighth Circuit had to step in again and issue a second reversal.
Two reversals. Wow, that really emphasizes how significant the legal issues were in this case. So let's break down the Eighth Circuit's reasoning here. What were the key errors that they identified?
All right, well, the first one was this tendency to what you might call compartmentalization. The trial court looked at each instance of harassment in isolation as if they were totally separate events. And because of this, they failed to grasp the full picture of what Burns was enduring.
I see. So they weren't acknowledging the cumulative impact of all those different instances, right? It's not just one comment here, one incident there. It's the whole environment that becomes toxic.
Exactly. The Eighth Circuit emphasized that you have to consider the totality of the circumstances. They argued that it's the pattern of behavior and the overall atmosphere created that truly defines a hostile work environment.
That makes sense. And that emphasis on totality of circumstances, I imagine that's had a lasting impact on how courts approach these kinds of cases.
Absolutely. It's a crucial legal principle now, and it came directly out of Burns v. McGregor.
All right, so that's one major error. What was the second problem the Eighth Circuit had with the trial court's decision?
This one might be the most infuriating. It was the trial court's fixation on Burns' modeling history. They basically argued that because she had posed for Easy Riders, she must have a higher tolerance for sexually suggestive behavior and therefore wouldn't be offended by the harassment at work.
Which is just so wrong on so many levels. It's like saying that someone who wears revealing clothes is asking to be assaulted.
It's the exact same flawed logic, and the Eighth Circuit completely shut it down. They made it crystal clear that a person's private life, their choices outside of work, have absolutely no bearing on their right to a dignified and harassment-free workplace. What someone does in their personal time is irrelevant when it comes to whether or not they experience harm from illegal harassment on the job.
Good. I'm glad they set that record straight. It should be obvious, but sadly, we know that kind of victim blaming is all too common. Okay, so that was the second big error. What was the third one?
The third one was how the trial court misunderstood the concept of unwelcomeness. They seemed to think that Burns had to explicitly object to every single instance of harassment for it to count as unwelcome.
So basically, unless she was shouting, "No, I don't like this," every time someone made an inappropriate comment or gesture, it wasn't considered harassment.
It seems that way. And the Eighth Circuit pointed out just how absurd and unrealistic that expectation is. They clarify that harassment is unwelcome if it is uninvited, regardless of whether the victim verbally protests in every single instance.
That makes sense, especially when you consider that people often freeze up or don't know how to respond in those situations, or they might be worried about the consequences of speaking up, especially if the harasser is their boss.
Precisely. The focus should be on whether the behavior was imposed upon the person without their consent, not on how they reacted in the moment.
And what about that final incident with Ottaway, the one where he used that horrific slur? The trial court had tried to write that off as just a personal argument.
Right, but the Eighth Circuit saw right through that. They refused to view that incident in isolation. They correctly identified it as the culmination of all the harassment that Burns had been subjected to. They understood that it wasn't some random personal spat. It was the breaking point that resulted from months, even years, of gender-based abuse.
That's such a crucial point because it highlights how seemingly isolated events can actually be part of a much larger, more insidious pattern.
Exactly. And recognizing those patterns is essential for effectively addressing and preventing workplace harassment.
So all of this taken together leads to, well, a pretty clear conclusion. The Eighth Circuit overturned the trial court's decision because it was based on a deeply flawed understanding of the law.
Absolutely.
Now, this case also really clarified a key legal test, right? The test for proving a hostile work environment claim under Title VII.
That's right. It reaffirmed a five-part test. First, the victim has to belong to a protected group, which in this case is sex. Second, they have to have experienced unwelcome harassment. Third, that harassment has to be based on their sex. Fourth, the harassment needs to be severe or pervasive enough to actually change the conditions of their employment and create a hostile work environment. And fifth, the employer has to have known or should have known about the harassment and failed to do anything to stop it.
Five elements. Okay, that's helpful to have it laid out like that. So the Eighth Circuit went through each of these elements in Burns's case and found that they were all met, right?
Exactly. They found that all five elements were present, meaning that Burns had a legitimate claim of a hostile work environment under Title VII.
And they didn't stop there, did they? Didn't they also invoke what's called the reasonable woman standard? What does that mean in this context?
Yeah, the reasonable woman standard is a really important concept here. It basically means that the court has to judge the harassment from the perspective of a reasonable woman in a similar situation.
So instead of asking, like, would any random person be offended by this behavior, they're asking, would a reasonable woman find it hostile?
Precisely. Because men and women, you know, due to societal norms and power dynamics, they often experience and perceive things differently. What might seem harmless to a man could be incredibly offensive and intimidating to a woman in the same situation.
I can see how that's a crucial distinction. And it's really about acknowledging the lived experiences of women, especially in a historically male-dominated environment like the workplace.
Absolutely.
Now, the Eighth Circuit was also pretty blunt about what the employer should have done in this situation, right? What did they say about MacGregor Electronics' responsibility?
They didn't mince words. They said that employers have a legal obligation to take action to prevent and address workplace harassment. They can't just sit back and hope it goes away.
And because MacGregor Electronics chose to ignore Burns' complaints, they were found to be in violation of Title VII.
That's right. Their inaction was deemed negligent and a breach of their legal duty to provide a safe and discrimination-free workplace.
So this case really underscored the idea that employers can't just turn a blind eye to harassment. They can be held accountable. What a powerful statement.
It really was. And, you know, it's important to remember, this wasn't just about the specific facts of Burns' case. It was about setting a legal precedent.
A precedent that had ripple effects throughout the legal system and beyond.
Absolutely. Hmm. I mean, if we zoom out and look at the broader impact of Burns v. MacGregor, we can identify three major shifts, or maybe affirmations, that it brought about.
Three key takeaways, so to speak. Okay, I'm all ears. Let's hear them.
Okay, the first is that this case really established the idea that there are no moral double standards when it comes to workplace harassment. In other words, what a person does in their personal life has no impact on their right to a harassment-free workplace. Their off-duty choices are not an invitation for abuse.
Right. Like in Burns' case, the fact that she posed for a magazine had absolutely no bearing on whether she deserved to be treated with respect on the job.
Exactly. It was a crucial step in pushing back against victim blaming and emphasizing that everyone, regardless of their background or personal choices, has the right to be safe and respected at work.
Okay, so that's a huge takeaway. What was the second major impact?
The second key point is that Burns v. MacGregor really solidified the importance of what we call holistic analysis in hostile work environment cases. That means that courts can't just look at isolated incidents. They have to consider the entire picture.
The totality of circumstances again?
Exactly. They need to understand the cumulative effect of all the harassment, the patterns of behavior, and the overall environment that's been created.
Because a bunch of smaller incidents taken together can be just as harmful as one big dramatic event.
Absolutely. Okay, so the third and final major impact is that this case really put a spotlight on employer accountability. It made it crystal clear that employers can't just ignore harassment when it's happening. They have a legal duty to address it head on.
And MacGregor Electronic Industries, you know, their failure to act is what ultimately got them in trouble.
Exactly. Their inaction made them complicit in the harassment. And, you know, as Judge Lay famously said in the Burns decision, and I'm going to quote him here, sexual harassment is an arbitrary barrier to equality, just like racial discrimination. It was a powerful statement that underscored how seriously the law takes this issue and how important it is for employers to take proactive steps to create a workplace free from harassment.
I love that quote. It really drives home the point that harassment is a form of discrimination, plain and simple, and it has no place in a just and equitable society.
Well said.
So for all of you listening out there, whether you're future lawyers, legal scholars, or just someone interested in understanding how the law works, I hope this deep dive into Burns v. McGregor has given you some valuable insights. This case truly lays a foundation for understanding how we can fight back against victim blaming and hold employers accountable for creating respectful workplaces.
I agree. It's an essential case for anyone studying employment law, and its impact continues to be felt today.
And on that note, here's something to ponder as you continue your legal journey. How might the principles established in Burns v. McGregor, especially this idea of considering the totality of circumstances and rejecting victim blaming, how might those apply to the ways we think about and address harassment that's happening online?
Yeah, that's an important question, because with the rise of social media and remote work, the lines between our personal and professional lives are becoming increasingly blurred. Unfortunately, harassment often follows us online.
It does. So how do we apply these legal principles to those new and evolving environments? How do we ensure that everyone has the right to a safe and respectful online experience, whether it's at work or in their personal lives?
I don't have all the answers, but it's a conversation we need to be having.
Absolutely. And we encourage you to continue exploring Title VII case law and thinking critically about how we can best protect individuals from all forms of harassment in our ever-changing world.
Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.
See you next time.